Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Kehan. Today we'll discuss the article by Mellor et al. Titled Fructose Diet-Induced Cardiomyocyte Calcium Cycling Abnormality. This article published online ahead of print December 23, 2011. My guests today are Associate Editor Meredith Bond, Senior Author Lee Delbridge, and leading expert Susan Howlett. Let's get started.
The focus of the work from the Delbridge Lab is to take a close look at cardiac-specific impacts and effects of high fructose intake in an experimental animal model. So I'd first like to ask Lee to sum up for us what her study has shown about fructose effects on cardiac function.
Thanks, Meredith. We've developed a mouse model of high fructose intake. And these fructose-fed mice don't get hypertensive and they don't get obese, but they do show hyperglycemia, glucose intolerance, and myocardial insulin resistance. So with our model, we can look at the direct cardiac effects of high fructose on excitation-contraction coupling without the confounding effects of hemodynamic loading. And we've been able to show for the first time that mouse cardiomyocytes actually express the fructose-specific transporter GLUT5, and they have the capacity to take up fructose. And the bottom line from our study is that after only 12 weeks feeding, the calcium handling in cardiomyocytes is profoundly altered. But what is particularly surprising is that the cardiomyocytes maintain their capacity to shorten in the situation by increasing their responsiveness to calcium.
I'd like to invite our expert, Susan, to comment on some of the strengths of the paper. Susan.
What was really exciting about the study was that it takes such an imaginative investigative approach. It's a highly mechanistic study, and they're looking at dissecting excitation contraction remodeling in this fructose feeding model. So what happens at a very early level, early in the fructose feeding, after only 12 weeks, that excitation contraction coupling derangement goes on. And this happens before you would see a loss of contractile function in vivo, or even at the level of the isolated cardiac myocyte. So there are things happening that you wouldn't see if you had not actually looked at calcium handling in the individual cells. And they have reported the novel finding that myocytes are capable of selective fructose transport, and they actually express the GLUT5 transporter.
Susan, are there some questions that you might have that related to the study that might lead on to further studies or further experimentation?
Well, I'd like to know whether or not Lee saw any evidence in the course of doing these experiments that could provide additional information about SR function, and whether she's contemplated some additional measurements to look at SR dysregulation in this really interesting model.
We can infer something about the SR function from what we did. We did not see any evidence of spontaneous calcium release in the form of after contractions, but I think that we need a much more thorough investigation looking at calcium influx, SR load, gain factor, and do a more forensic analysis of SR calcium spike activity. I think that's definitely a direction for us to head now. We know what we know.
Lee showed very convincingly that the GLUT5 mRNA expression in the myocyte factions was greater than the mixed cell homogenate, and it shows that you see the GLUT5 gene expression as myocyte specific, but I wondered why they didn't look at the protein levels.
Well, we actually did try very hard to do that. That's another good question. We tried a whole range of tactics to get a protein measure on the GLUT5, but unfortunately we couldn't succeed. We weren't confident that we were getting the right positive and negative controls. So I think we're in a situation where we have to wait for the advent of a new GLUT5 antibody to help us out with this.
The other interesting finding was that there was an actual increase in calcium responsiveness that maintained contractile function in the face of lower calcium levels. And this was demonstrated to be a result of a myosin, a heavy chain isoform switch to an increase in alpha to beta ratio. And this is rather unusual and often associated with a good phenotype rather than a pathology.
Yes, this myosin heavy chain isoform switch was really quite surprising because normally a switch to a beta isoform form rather than an alpha is considered to be an economical strategy that the cell uses. So our observation that there was an increase in the alpha isoform was surprising, but there is a precedent in another stress situation, and it was associated in that setting with a transgenic model to increase the alpha isoform, and that produced a more advantageous outcome in functional challenge. The increased phosphatase 2A activity could lead to the dephosphorylation of troponin I, which then in turn relieves the inhibition on the myosin ATPase activity to keep the calcium bound longer to the troponin C. We need to do some more signaling work on that.
I would be interested to hear your comments on the sodium hydrogen exchange. You didn't see an increase in the expression of the proton efflux transporter. If you had a more active exchanger, it would make the pH more alkaline. It could affect calcium sensitivity of the myofilaments. Do you have a comment on that?
Yes, that was interesting, Susan, that we did not see a change in the sodium hydrogen exchanger expression, because we have seen it in another model where we knocked out the GLUT4 transporter to create insulin resistance. What we don't have at the moment are functional measurements of how the sodium hydrogen exchanger is working, and that will tell us whether, even though the expression levels are not changed, that the way the protons are being removed and handled could be different. So we need to do more experiments with microfluorimetry to understand how the cell is handling a pH load.
If we just sort of step up to the organ level, perhaps you can provide us with some insights. What's known about the tissue and cellular and structural changes in this high fructose insulin resistant state?
Well, firstly, we've shown in this model that there is no evidence of cardiomyocyte hypertrophy. But I think our most interesting structural finding is that with this fructose feeding intervention, the cell survival signaling is suppressed and the collagen levels of the extracellular matrix are increased. So the evidence is that in this insulin-resistant state, we are losing cardiomyocytes at a relatively slow but significant rate, and we think this is being mediated through autophagic cell death mechanisms. So we've got a scenario in these hearts where the myocytes are dying and there's encroachment of fibrosis, and meanwhile these surviving myocytes are exhibiting sort of a functionally invisible adaptation of their calcium handling.
So in terms of this functional change and the increased fibrosis, can you predict if you were to extend the feeding time beyond the current protocol that you used in this paper, whether some of these changes may no longer be compensatory? What are your thoughts about that?
We would like to move this work forward to look at longer-term feeding periods. And I think that your inference is right, that we might move into a failure scenario. That would be what we would expect on the basis of human disease model. And in particular, I think that there's evidence to suggest that we could have a diastolic-related failure, because if the cells keep becoming more responsive to calcium, then inevitably they will not be able to relax properly.
So I'd like to direct a final question to Susan. What do you think perhaps are some of the important unanswered questions related to excitation contraction mechanisms that this study would lead us to think about?
As I mentioned earlier, there's a need to do some direct measurements of SR function to come to an understanding of the type of remodeling that's going on in these cells in response to the fructose feeding. I think there's also a priority to try and understand more clearly what's happening with the calcium sensitivity of the myofilaments, and perhaps directly measure calcium responsiveness with some measurements, perhaps using a skin fiber preparation. It would be also interesting to look in detail at some of the other EC coupling parameters. I think it would be important to look at calcium current, for example, and EC coupling gain, along with calcium sparks, which links into SR function. And I think these would be really interesting directions to go in as this work moves forward.
This has been a great discussion, some exciting new findings from the Delbridge Lab, and I would say some very important implications for our understanding of diabetic cardiomyopathy. So we await further developments, hopefully in the near future.
And thanks for listening to this AJP Heart and Circ podcast.